December 11th, 1995, Washington, D.C. The fire department is summoned to a townhouse and discovers the burning body of 38-year-old Lynn Amos on her bed. Lynn is still alive at the time and taken to a hospital with burns on the majority of her body, but she passes away 10 days later. While investigators initially believe that Lynn's death was an accident, traces of accelerants are found on the bed to indicate that arson took place and she was the victim of a homicide. There is speculation that Lynn was murdered because of something she uncovered at her job as a financial analyst, but the identity of her killer and their motive remain a mystery. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a pair of cold cases which were featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the 1995 murder of Lynn Amos and the 2000 murder of Megan Curl. While there is no connection between these two cases, the one thing they have in common is that they are both particularly brutal and sadistic crimes where the respective victims had their bodies set on fire on their beds. While our second victim, Megan Curl, was likely killed before her body was burned, our first victim, Lynn Amos, was still alive at the time and held on for 10 days until she died. Lynn worked as a financial analyst for a management consulting firm, and shortly before her death, she implied that she had uncovered something in her job which may have put her life at risk. Indeed, there are some aspects of Lynn's murder that give off the impression that a professional hit took place, as the arson was staged to fool investigators into initially believing that the fire was an accident. Now, the circumstances of how Megan Curl was killed are not quite as mysterious, as on the night of her death, she had been out to some nightclubs, and a man whom she had apparently met there was seen inside Megan's apartment by one of her neighbors. It seems obvious that this man was the killer, but he remains unidentified to this day, and no one knows why he decided to murder Megan in such a sadistic fashion. Indeed, both of these crimes are pretty puzzling in their own way, so on this episode, I'll start off by discussing Lynn's case before I share my theories and analysis, and then I'll move on to Megan's case. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the murder of Lynn Amos. Our first story begins in Washington, D.C. in 1995. Our first victim is 38-year-old Lynn Amos, who lives in a rented townhouse in the Georgetown district. Originally born in Montgomery, Alabama, Lynn earned a Bachelor of Arts from the University of Alabama and spent 3 years touring as a cast member and staff member of Up With People, an international organization which produces musical performances while promoting community service and understanding among nations. But Lynn decided to change her career path when she earned a master's degree in business administration from the University of Texas, so she entered the world of finance. At this particular point, Lynn has lived in Washington for 5 months, as she moved there to take a job as an international financial analyst for a management consulting firm called the Barron's Group. At around 10 p.m. on the evening of December the 10th, Lynn phoned her office and told them she was going to be late for work the following day. The conversation lasted about 30 minutes before it ended, but sometime within the next 5 hours, Lynn would become the victim of a brutal crime. At 3:30 a.m. on the morning of December the 11th, the fire department was summoned to Lynn's residence after a neighbor noticed flames on the townhouse's second floor. When firefighters arrived and rushed into the upstairs bedroom, they discovered that the bed was on fire and immediately extinguished it, but they soon noticed that Lynn's badly burned body was lying there. Lynn was unconscious and still alive at this point, so she was immediately rushed to the hospital for treatment. She had third-degree burns over 80% of her body, and one of the paramedics who examined her would later say, quote, "For someone who was still alive, it was one of the worst burn injuries I've ever seen," end quote. Lynn was barely lucid, but at one point, a nurse at the hospital asked her if she knew what happened, but since Lynn was unable to speak, she simply shook her head. In spite of her horrific burns, Lynn managed to hang on for 10 days before she passed away on December the 31st. At the time she was found, Lynn had a blood alcohol level of 0.25, which was more than 2.5 times the legal limit for driving in Washington, D.C. A cigarette butt was found among the bedding, which had been swept out onto a deck by firefighters, so investigators were initially inclined to believe that Lynn had started the fire after dropping the cigarette while intoxicated, making her death a tragic accident. However, Lynn's friends and family did not believe this, as she was not a smoker, and the presence of the cigarette butt did not make much sense, as no other cigarettes, matches, or ashtrays could be found anywhere in the residence. Sure enough, when insurance investigators examined Lynn's bedroom, they discovered the presence of accelerants on the mattress, floor, and pillow, which appeared to be a mixture of gasoline, kerosene, and turpentine. It now became apparent that the fire was a deliberate act of arson, and the cigarette butt was left behind in order to create the false impression that Lynn's death was accidental. The arson was staged in such a way that it was restricted to the bedroom and did not cause the rest of the house to go up in flames. Since it only caused about $15,000 worth of damage, one investigator would describe it as a controlled fire, which did not do more damage than it needed to. After insurance investigators submitted their report to police, the medical examiner officially ruled Lynn's death to be a homicide. Unfortunately, since the fire was initially assumed to be an accident, the residence was not secured in order to preserve evidence, and within 12 hours of Lynn being found, the house's owner was already arranging for repairs to be made. No one could figure out a motive for Lynn's murder, as she had no known enemies, and even though she had an active social circle, she was not dating anyone at that time. But there was speculation that the crime was somehow tied to Lynn's job, as her work as an international financial analyst required her to make frequent trips to Mexico in order to assess the lending practices of some of their largest banks. A few weeks prior to her death, Lynn had lunch with a friend of hers, and told her that she was working on a project in Mexico which required her to examine some credit issues with a bank, and she wound up discovering some very bad lending practices. When asked about the report she was planning to issue on the matter, Lynn described it as, quote-unquote, really ugly. For the next month, Lynn refused to talk about her job with her friends, even when they pressed her for more details about what she was doing. On December the 10th, the day before the fire, Lynn had brunch with some friends and told them she had seen some quote-unquote dangerous things during her investigation in Mexico, though she would not provide any specific details. Lynn also mentioned that she had been receiving mysterious hang-up calls at her home. In retrospect, some of her friends began to speculate that Lynn may have discovered some sort of fraudulent loan during her investigation, which was a cover for drug money. Indeed, Lynn's family consulted with an attorney who expressed their belief that Lynn was the victim of a professional hit. When Lynn phoned her employer on the evening of December the 10th, she was described as sounding lucid and normal, so something obviously happened to her after the call ended. Since there were no signs of forced entry at Lynn's residence, it was speculated that her killer either had a key or Lynn willingly let them inside. Lynn's abnormally high blood alcohol content of 0.25 may have been caused by the perpetrator forcing to drink large amounts of alcohol to render her unconscious. For a woman of Lynn's size to become that intoxicated, she would have needed to consume between 9 to 14 drinks per hour, rounding out to a new drink every 4 to 7 minutes, and it seemed impossible that she could do that on her own. Afterward, the killer spread accelerants all over Lynn's body and her bed before they started the fire, and also left a cigarette butt at the scene in order to stage things to look like an accident. The report Lynn had been working on about the Mexican banks was never completed, so it was unclear what she might have uncovered, which put her life at risk. The case garnered national attention when it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries in December of 1996, but Lynn's employer, the Barron's Group, declined to appear on the show or comment on her investigation. Instead, they sent a letter to the show containing this statement, quote, "We are troubled by the same questions being asked by investigators. We can only hope that forensic science will provide some answers," end quote. Sadly, the Amos family would suffer a number of tragedies over the next several years, as Lynn's father, Doug Amos Sr., passed away in October of 1999, while her mother, Helen Amos, died in June of 2004. In addition, Lynn's older sister Leslie passed away in August of 2001 at the age of 46, so the lone surviving member of the family is Lynn's brother, Doug Amos Jr. It does not sound like there have been any developments in the investigation these past 25 years, so Lynn's baffling murder continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So this is definitely one of the most disturbing cases ever featured on Unsolved Mysteries, not only because of the brutal nature of how Lynn Amos was murdered, but because she did not immediately die, and lived for another 10 days in what must have been indescribable pain, with burns on over 80% of her body. Since she was in such bad shape and could not speak, there was no way investigators could have questioned Lynn before she died in order to try and figure out what happened. All we have is the account from the nurse, who claimed that she tried to ask Lynn if she knew what happened, and she simply shook her head, no. Since Lynn was barely lucid at this point, there's no way of knowing if this was a genuine answer to the nurse's question, or nothing more than a reflex action. But it does make you wonder if Lynn genuinely had no clue about who her attacker was and why they did this to her. It's incredibly frustrating just how little available information there is out there about this case. It got some coverage in the Washington Post at the time it happened, as well as the Montgomery Advertiser, the newspaper from Lynn's original hometown, but it seems like after the Unsolved Mysteries segment aired in December of 1996, there's been no new developments at all, and I have no idea if this is still an active investigation. I just mentioned that Lynn's parents and sister have since passed away, and the only surviving member of her family is her brother, Doug Jr. Well, in May of 2021, someone claiming to be Doug showed up on Lynn's profile page at the official Unsolved Mysteries website and left a very interesting comment. Keep in mind that the comment section at this website is not particularly well moderated, so I have no idea if this person is actually Doug. But I still thought I should share what he wrote, as he makes a very interesting statement about Lynn's employer. Quote, "I am Lynn's brother, and the only member of the immediate family still alive. About a decade ago, through a friend within the CIA, I was told it would be best not to look into Lynn's murder any longer. I did discover that the Barron's Group was an operative for the CIA. We're obviously not sure if Lynn was aware of that fact. I, as well as others, believe that my sister was killed by the company she worked for or by her own country." End quote. That sounds pretty sensationalistic, but if Doug is being truthful, that might help explain why there seems to have been no progress in the investigation these past 25 years. However, what could Lynn have possibly uncovered that led to her being murdered in this fashion? This crime has a number of similarities to another case which was once featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and that's the disappearance of 56-year-old Lee Young, whose abandoned, burned-out car was discovered in the Arizona desert in May of 1990. I went into more detail about this case on my Trail Went Cold episode about the disappearance of Leonard Derrickson, which I covered earlier this year on episode number 275. It sounds like Lee Young had a job that was similar to Lynn's, as he worked as a bank fraud investigator, and in the months prior to his disappearance, he had reportedly been in touch with federal drug agents because he suspected his bank was being used as a money laundering ring, which involved a Colombian drug cartel. But much like this case, it seems like after Lee's disappearance was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the investigation ground to a dead halt. Lee has never been found, and it hasn't been publicly confirmed if there was ever a money laundering ring to begin with. You can see the parallels here, as prior to Lynn's murder, she was assessing the lending practices of Mexican banks. She would not provide any specific details about what she had uncovered, but it seemed obvious to Lynn's friends that the situation perturbed her, and she implied that she was going to make major waves when she issued a report about her findings. So could Lynn have uncovered evidence that a bank was involved with laundering drug money? Well, since this report of hers was never completed, we have no idea if it has any relevance to her murder. The Barron's Group declined to participate in the Unsolved Mysteries segment, and in fact, the show did not even use their name, only referring to them as a quote-unquote management consulting firm. From doing an internet search on them, I could see that the Barron's Group described themselves as specializing in economic consulting in development countries and U.S. Agency for International Development contracts. They were originally incorporated on September 28, 1995, which would have been the approximate time period that Lynn started working for them, but it looks like the firm permanently closed on June 30, 2010. I couldn't find any information out there about why the Barron's Group closed, or any scandals they might have been involved in which led to their downfall, but we do have that unverified comment from Doug Amos Jr. about the firm being an operative for the CIA. Indeed, Lynn's family and friends believed that her murder had all the hallmarks of a professional hit. It seems like the responsible party forced Lynn to get very drunk and left a cigarette butt at the scene to make her death look like an accident. This plan almost worked, and unfortunately, since the crime was not immediately treated as a homicide investigation, potential evidence may have been lost or compromised. It seems like the perpetrator may have been an experienced arsonist, since they intentionally staged the fire to be a controlled burn, which only set Lynn and her bed ablaze without damaging the rest of the house. There was also a sadistic nature to the fact that Lynn was still alive when the perpetrator started the fire. I mentioned in this episode's intro that Megan Curl was likely already dead before her body was set on fire, but here, you have to wonder if the killer wanted to cause the maximum amount of pain and suffering for Lynn, so much so that she did not die for days. However, since there's no concrete evidence that Lynn's death was connected to her job, or it was some sort of professional hit orchestrated by the CIA or a Mexican drug cartel, could this have been a more personal crime, completely unconnected to any of that? Well, let's look at the series of events on the night of the crime. The last time Lynn was confirmed to be alive was when she phoned her employer from 10 until 10:30 p.m. to say that she would be late for work the following morning. You could assume that the killer forced her to make this phone call under duress, but this seems unlikely, since the conversation lasted for about half an hour, and the person she spoke to didn't notice anything unusual with Lynn. You almost might wonder if Lynn being late for work the following morning might somehow be connected to what happened to her. Well, I know that Unsolved Mysteries reenactments are not always 100% accurate, but their segment contains a reenactment where Lynn tells her employer that she has a doctor's appointment in the morning, so if this is true, then the explanation for her being late might be completely mundane. But since there were no signs of forced entry at Lynn's residence when the fire department arrived, this opens up questions about how the killer got inside to begin with. Two scenarios which have been pushed forward is that the perpetrator somehow obtained a key or a copy of a key, or Lynn willingly invited them inside. Since it was late at night, I seriously doubt that Lynn would have invited a stranger into her residence. So could her killer have been an individual she knew and trusted? Well, Lynn was not known to be dating anyone at the time, and as far as I can tell, she never told her friends and family about any potential relationships. It shouldn't be too surprising that Lynn was single, as she had only been living in D.C. for 5 months, and since her job required a lot of travel and she was working on an important project, it sounds like it pretty much consumed her life. But if Lynn had become romantically involved with someone, and she willingly invited this person over to her place that night, how did this lead to her being murdered in such a sadistic fashion? We also have the comment from her brother about Lynn possibly being killed by the company she worked for, so could the perpetrator have been a coworker she trusted enough to let inside her residence? One of the most disturbing parts of the Unsolved Mysteries segment is the reenactment where Lynn's killer forces her to drink bottles of alcohol against her will. As you recall, her blood alcohol level at the time of her death was a ridiculously high 0.25, and since there was a window of approximately 5 hours between when Lynn finished her final phone call and the fire department arrived, it seemed impossible the lid could have consumed enough to reach that level without passing out. This is why it's been theorized that the killer forced her to drink it so that the authorities would assume that she got intoxicated and accidentally caused the fire with a lit cigarette, and I'm sure all the alcohol in her system would have caused her to burn faster. This whole situation is very bizarre, because in order for her to reach that blood alcohol level, she would have needed to consume around a dozen drinks per hour over the course of several hours, and that takes an awful lot of time and increases the risk of the perpetrator being caught. While I can understand why they would do this in order to fabricate an accidental fire scenario, it again makes you wonder if this was really a professional hit, or the killer was just someone who got off on torturing Lynn and prolonging her ordeal before her death. If it was an assassination connected to something like money laundering, you'd think that a professional would want to commit the crime as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, there haven't been any details released publicly about whether a lot of empty liquor bottles were found at the scene, as it would have been helpful to know if Lynn ordinarily kept that much alcohol in her residence, or if the killer might have brought it with them. Given that Lynn's death was initially ruled to be an accident, I'd hate to think that investigators just decided to toss some empty bottles out before they could be analyzed as evidence and checked for any DNA or fingerprints. The one piece of evidence which was found at the scene and helped convince fire investigators that this was an arson was the cigarette butt. It clearly did not belong to Lynn, since she never smoked, and did not even have anything in the house to light the cigarette to begin with, so the perpetrator likely planted it there in order to give off the impression that Lynn dropped it. These past several years, we've seen countless cold cases get solved because investigators obtained the perpetrator's DNA from a discarded cigarette butt. Theoretically, this could be the one piece of evidence which could help identify Lynn's killer, but since the cigarette may have been burned and consumed by the fire, it's unclear if there's any usable DNA evidence still on it. So overall, I'm really not sure what to make of this whole crime, as I do think there is evidence that leans both towards and away from the theory that Lynn's murder was a professional hit. But if this wasn't somehow connected to her work with the Barents Group, then I have no idea what the motive could be. Given the secretive nature of the events surrounding Lynn's death, and the fact that there seemed to have been no major developments in over 25 years, I would not be surprised if there was truth to Doug's comment about Lynn being killed over something related to her work. If the Barents Group was involved in some shady stuff, and was somehow connected to the CIA, or drugs, or money laundering, Lynn may have had no knowledge of this when she took the position, and soon found herself in way over her head. It was apparently common practice for Lynn to talk about her job with friends, but since she seemed to stop doing that in the weeks prior to her death, this would indicate that she may have found something that disturbed her and put her life in danger. Unfortunately, with no hard evidence pointing in any direction, we can only speculate, but I definitely would rank this as one of the most puzzling and sadistic cases featured on Unsolved Mysteries. I do think it's important to keep her story alive on the chance that there might be a resolution someday and Lynn will finally receive justice. So if you happen to have any information on the murder of Lynn Amos, please contact the appropriate authorities. And now let's move on to our next case. Our second story begins in 2000 in Lufkin, Texas, and our second victim is 26-year-old Megan Curl. Megan was originally born at the Incirlik Air Base in Adana, Texas, as her father, Ernest Romero, was serving in the United States Air Force and living there with her mother, Sherry McClung. The couple would go on to have two sons, but when she entered school, Megan found herself struggling. By the time she reached first grade, Megan was officially diagnosed as having a mild mental disability and forced to take special education classes. Even though people often picked on and made fun of Megan as she was growing up, she was always known for being a very kind person who still had nice words for those who did not treat her well. While Megan was in high school, her family settled in Lufkin, though her parents would eventually divorce. When she reached the age of 18, Megan got married and moved to Arkansas with her husband. His full name has never been released publicly, but his surname was Curl, and Meghan would continue to use it even after the marriage came to an end. Meghan's husband turned out to be abusive, so after 3 years, she separated from him and moved back to Lufkin. Meghan eventually moved into her own apartment at the Fox Run Apartments complex and found a job at a Pilgrim's Pride chicken processing plant. Due to Meghan's naivete and her constant desire to please people, her friends and family were always concerned that other men would take advantage of her, but Meghan was a regular patron at a number of nightclubs in Lufkin and was always on the lookout for companionship. On the evening of March the 25th, Meghan went to a club called the Electric Cowboy and was seen speaking to an unidentified man who bought her drinks. The man may have been Hispanic and was described as having a dark complexion, dark hair, a goatee, and he wore a cowboy hat. However, at some point during the evening, Meghan would be asked to leave the club for doing what was described as provocative dancing, so she went to another club called the Sports Shack. After spending some time there, a bouncer who was a friend of Meghan's drove her back to her apartment complex, and she arrived sometime after 1:30 a.m. on March the 26th. Meghan then spoke to a friend and neighbor whose identity has never been disclosed publicly. The two women were chatting outside when Meghan started crying and told her neighbor that she just wanted someone to love her. All of a sudden, a speeding car pulled into the parking lot and came to a complete stop. The man behind the wheel did not exit the vehicle, but when Meghan looked at him, she told her neighbor that she believed it was a friend from the club, so she went down to say hi to him. The neighbor watched Meghan approach the driver's side door and speak to the man before she returned to her own apartment. A few minutes later, the neighbor came back outside and noticed that Meghan was now inside the car with this man. She went back into her apartment again for a brief period, and when she came back out, she noticed that the car was still parked there, but it was now empty. At around 2:20 a.m., the neighbor decided to go to Meghan's apartment to check on her and knocked on the door. When Meghan opened the door, the neighbor noticed that a man was sitting on the couch inside the apartment behind her, and he proceeded to nod without saying a word. Meghan confirmed that the man was a friend of hers from the club, and while the neighbor briefly expressed her concern about the situation, Meghan assured her that everything was fine, so they went their separate ways. The neighbor would later describe this individual as being a white male who appeared to be in his mid-20s or early 30s, with blonde hair, a slight mustache, and gold-rimmed glasses. At around 4 a.m., another neighbor of Meghan's was awakened by the smell of smoke, walked outside to see flames coming out of her apartment, so he called the fire department. When they arrived and entered Meghan's apartment, they discovered that her bed was in flames and immediately extinguished them. But they soon noticed that Meghan's dead body was lying on the bed. Her arms and legs had been tied to the bedpost with pantyhose and a belt, and since she was burned beyond recognition, dental records would be used to identify her. It would turn out that someone had suffocated Meghan by placing a plastic bag over her head and slashed her throat with two deep cuts on each side before setting the bed on fire. A remnant of a burned nightgown was found on Meghan's body, and according to some of her former partners, Meghan usually slept in shorts and a t-shirt, and only put on a nightgown or negligee if she was planning to engage in sexual activity. So it seemed likely that Meghan had planned to get intimate with the man seen in her apartment before he proceeded to murder her in a sadistic fashion. In addition to the man from the apartment, investigators wanted to find the other man in the cowboy hat who had been seen buying drinks for Meghan at the Electric Cowboy earlier that evening. No one from the club knew who he was or had seen him there before or since, and while police did not consider him to be a suspect, they still wanted to question him in case he saw or heard something that was useful to the investigation. However, the man with the cowboy hat was never found or identified. The case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in December of 2000, but while some new tips came in, they did not lead to a resolution. Of course, all of Meghan's former spouses were investigated as possible suspects, but they all seemed to have alibis on the night of the crime. In spite of this, there was still some suspicion directed towards an ex-boyfriend of Meghan's named Tim Purvis, who had a criminal history and was released from prison just 1 week before Meghan was murdered. No evidence was ever found to implicate Tim in the crime, but on June the 19th, 2003, he suffered a serious accident when he fell off a water tower in the town of Hudson. Tim refused to seek medical treatment, but when he returned home and went to sleep, he never woke up and succumbed to his injuries at the age of 32. In January of 2012, Libby Parrish, the first female police officer in the history of Lufkin, was featured in the Lufkin Daily News after she retired following a 22-year career. Parrish had worked on the investigation into Megan's murder and claimed that it always haunted her, stating, quote, "We think we know who did it, but I don't suppose we will ever have anything to prove to us without the shadow of a doubt what really happened. I have nightmares about Megan Curl. I suppose I will always have nightmares about her," end quote. However, neither Parrish nor anyone else in law enforcement has ever publicly released the identity of the person they believe was Megan's killer. Even though investigators have confirmed that they do have DNA evidence in this case, it has yet to lead them towards a suspect. Sadly, Megan's father, Ernest Romero, passed away in July of 2014 at the age of 67 without receiving answers about who killed his daughter. Megan's mother, Sherry McClung, went into a deep depression following her murder and stated during a 2013 interview in the Lufkin Daily News, quote, "I don't want a court hearing. I don't want to put anybody in prison. I just want someone to tell me what happened. I guess I'll find out when I meet Jesus, but I won't have to worry about it anyway because I'll be with Megan," end quote. Megan is buried at White House Cemetery in Lufkin under her maiden name, Megan Kristen Romero, but after 2 decades, her murder continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So if you were to ask an Unsolved Mysteries fan to list the most brutal and senseless crimes ever featured on the show, I'm sure the Megan Curl case would rank right near the very top. Not only was she a particularly vulnerable victim because of her disabilities, but this crime pretty much defined the term overkill, as Megan was tied to a bed, suffocated by a plastic bag, had her throat slashed, and was then set on fire. We don't know the exact circumstances of how Megan's murder played out, but she may have been tortured before she was killed. And another shocking element of this crime was just how brazen it really was. It seems very likely that the killer was the unidentified man seen in Megan's apartment by her neighbor, but even though he would have known that an eyewitness could place him there, this did not deter him from going through with the murder. Unlike the Lynn Amos case, the circumstances of how the victim was killed are not a complete mystery, as it's pretty obvious who was responsible. The only thing we don't know is the identity of the perpetrator, and there are also some questions about their motive. The fact that Megan appeared to be dressed in a nightgown when she was killed suggests that she invited the killer into her apartment for sex, and while I guess her death could have been the result of some sort of sex game gone wrong, the violent nature of the crime seems to indicate it was premeditated. This individual may have had a major personal grudge against Megan, or perhaps they were just a sadistic person in general who has possibly harmed or killed other people. During our interview on Unsolved Mysteries, Megan's mother, Sherry McClung, expressed her belief that Megan knew and trusted her killer since she was seen climbing into his car in the parking lot. But on the other hand, Sherry also mentioned that Megan was a vulnerable person who yearned to please people and could easily be taken advantage of, so it would not surprise me if she did not know the man in the car all that well and had just met him earlier that night. Indeed, when the man arrived, Megan told her neighbor that he was a quote-unquote friend from the club. They don't mention this during the Unsolved Mysteries segment, but when Megan first returned to her apartment complex, her neighbor said she was crying and saying that she wanted someone to love her. It sounds like Megan was in a pretty vulnerable state, so when this man suddenly pulled up in the parking lot, she may have been overjoyed to see him at that point, even if she barely knew him. So it's been established that Megan frequented 2 local nightclubs that evening and was kicked out of the first one, the Electric Cowboy, because she was dancing provocatively. And incidentally, the reenactment of the scene on Unsolved Mysteries is unintentionally hilarious, as the supposedly provocative dancing delivered by the actress playing Megan almost resembles Elaine Bennis's terrible dancing on Seinfeld. We have these eyewitness sightings of Megan at the Electric Cowboy with an unidentified Hispanic-looking man in a cowboy hat, but since he did not resemble the man seen at Megan's apartment, he was likely not the killer. This other man was described as being blonde and wearing glasses, and as far as I can tell, it does not sound like there were any confirmed sightings of him at the Electric Cowboy or the other club Megan frequented, the Sports Shack. But if this man was a stranger who didn't know Megan and just met her that night, how would he have known where her apartment complex was? Megan was driven home by a bouncer from the Sports Shack, so I think there's a good chance that the perpetrator met her there and followed them. Many people would likely be creeped out if a stranger they met at a club suddenly showed up in their parking lot, but because of her trusting nature, Megan may not have seen things that way. But we also have to look at the possibility that Megan was not killed by a stranger, but someone she knew from her personal life. We know that Megan had some troubled relationships in the past, including an abusive marriage and an ex-boyfriend who spent time in prison, but it's been reported that they were all investigated and each of them had alibis to account for their whereabouts on the night of the crime. And of course, even though Megan's neighbor saw the likely killer inside her apartment, she did not recognize him. I'd like to think that if investigators believed that any of Megan's friends and former spouses might be responsible, they would have shown their photographs to the neighbor to see if she could identify them. Now, the main reason this is such a big sticking point is because of the timing of Megan's ex-boyfriend, Tim Purvis, getting out of prison just 1 week before her murder. This definitely raises a lot of questions, but I might have some clarification on some of them. Okay, so there's a thread about this case on the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which I'm always frequenting, and it contains a number of interesting comments from a poster under the username BootsDaddy. This person hails from Lufkin and claims to have known Megan and Tim Purvis and some of the other people associated with this case. In fact, the poster even said they were interviewed by the Lufkin PD and the days following the crime. BootsDaddy provided a bit more backstory about Tim Purvis, as they claimed Tim was abusive towards Megan, so much so that she had a restraining order against him. In fact, Megan had once testified about Tim's domestic violence, and this led to his parole being revoked and him being sent back to prison. So it's tempting to believe that Tim might have been seeking revenge against Megan when he was released. I know we're talking about a message board commenter, so of course I can't verify that everything BootsDaddy wrote is true, but one reason I think they're credible is because they posted a photo of Tim Purvis's mugshot in the thread. The mugshot was taken in May of 2000 and posted alongside the composite sketch of the man seen at Megan's apartment, and I have to admit there is a decent resemblance. However, BootsDaddy expressed their belief that Tim was not responsible for this crime and shared some points which pointed away from him. They claimed that Tim never wore glasses and did not own a car at that time, even though the man who killed Megan showed up at the apartment complex in a vehicle. Details are not clear about Tim's alibi that night, but according to BootsDaddy, the police showed up at his residence to question him within hours of Megan's murder and found him passed out drunk. Tim was also apparently a regular at the Electric Cowboy, so if he had shown up there and interacted with Megan on the night of her death, people likely would have recognized him. I previously mentioned some comments that Lufkin police officer Libby Parrish made when she retired about how investigators had a pretty good idea who killed Megan, but just did not have the evidence to prove it. BootsDaddy expressed their belief that Parrish was referring to Tim Purvis, who can no longer face justice since he's dead, but we've already outlined a number of troubling holes in that theory. It's unclear if Megan's neighbor would have known who Tim was or been able to recognize him, but I'd like to think that at some point, investigators would have shown her Tim's photograph and she could confirm or deny if he was the man she saw. Of course, Megan never referred to the man as her ex-boyfriend, only her friend from the club, and if Tim was violent and abusive and Megan had a restraining order against him, why would she invite Tim into her apartment? I mean, yes, Megan was described as being naive and trusting, but if she was willing to testify against him in order to send him back to prison, would she still have wanted anything to do with him anymore? If Tim held a grudge against Megan, I guess an alternate theory is that this could have been a murder for hire, and Tim got another man to kill his ex-girlfriend as revenge. I don't think that's very likely, but even if this theory was true, there's still someone else out there who committed this crime on Tim's behalf and deserves to be arrested. After all these years, I have no idea if investigators still believe that Tim might be the killer, but since he's dead, how can they ever conclusively prove or disprove this theory? Well, the obvious answer is genetic genealogy, as we've seen numerous cold cases get solved these past few years after genetic genealogy conclusively linked DNA evidence to a suspect, even though they were already deceased by that point. Over the years, investigators have indicated that there is DNA evidence in this case, though they never shared any specific details. If Megan was sexually assaulted, there's a good chance that setting fire to her body could have eradicated any DNA the killer left behind, but I get the impression that DNA was found somewhere at the scene, though it's never been linked to a suspect. I have no idea if investigators have considered the possibility of using genetic genealogy in this case, but even though Tim Purvis is dead, this process could either prove he was the killer or lead them to an alternate suspect. Whoever the killer was, I get the impression that anyone who could murder a vulnerable woman like Megan in such a brutal fashion has been responsible for harming other people, so it would not surprise me at all if this was not his first or only murder. So if you happen to have any information about the murder of Megan Curl, please contact the Lufkin Police Department at 936-633-0356. That's 936-633-0356. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a special Halloween-themed bonus episode about the infamous Falcon Lake incident, where a man named Stephen Michalak supposedly came across a UFO inside a provincial park in Manitoba, which caused him to receive some unexplained burns on his body. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, covered yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1991 murder of Suya Kim. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listener who has signed up with us on Patreon this week, and that's Emily F. Thank you so much for your support. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which, like I said, has a lot of interesting comments about this case, as well as the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composed the ear music here on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.